Welcome to your turn, Mike Causey. Glad to have you with us today. I think there's some snow in the forecast, so be prepared. But meantime, we're going to be talking, have a very interesting show. We're going to be talking with Jackie Simon. She is Director of Public Policy for the American Federation of Government Employees. AFGE is the largest of the federal employee groups and very active on Capitol Hill. Jackie, are you there?
I am.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for agreeing to come on and talk to us. It's been a while since we got to chat. Jackie, there's been an 18-month campaign, by my count, in the media, with using data mostly supplied by conservative think tanks, some of it government data, which has been indicating that federal employees are vastly overpaid any way you look at it. This came out, USA Today did it, the Wall Street Journal has done it, the Washington Times, and there have even been some articles in the Washington Post about it. Now we have this Congressional Budget Office study, which is Congress's own study, which said a little more realistically, but it said that you're comparing apples and oranges here, and that, in fact, the government seems to overpay at the lower grades, but dramatically underpay at the higher grades. What's your take on this study?
Well, honestly, I've been working in Washington for a little over 25 years, and I can tell you, and I look at a lot of CBO studies, and this is a real departure for CBO. It's by far and away the worst thing I've ever seen out of CBO. And that's when, that's in over many, many years. It's important to know, although no newspaper article has described it accurately, the question that the CBO study answered. And if you understand what the question they asked, then you see, how political it was and how misleading and ultimately useless it is for making the comparison between federal and non-federal pay. Here's the question they asked. If you got rid of the current federal workforce and hired a new federal workforce that had the exact same demographic profile as the current federal workforce. In other words, it had the same number of blacks and whites and Hispanics and old people and young people and married and unmarried and old and young and male and female and all those kind of demographic criteria. If you got a new workforce and you paid them the average wages in the private sector for people in those demographic categories, how much would it cost? Would you save money or would it cost more? Okay? That's the question.
Isn't world's that a longest question, too, yeah.
I know, and it's a stupid question. Because we all know, or at least those of us who, are labor economists, we all know that in the private sector, even for people in the same kind of job, same kind of occupation, women make less than men, blacks make less than whites, Hispanics make less than whites, whites make less than Asians. I mean, these are the data. Okay? You can attribute it to anything you want. If you don't want to attribute it to discrimination, it's kind of not really the point whether or not there's discrimination in the private sector. But the fact of the matter is that blacks and whites in the same occupations in the private sector don't make the same pay. But in the federal government, generally speaking, if you're black or you're white or you're turquoise or you're purple, if you're in the same federal job, you're going to make roughly the same amount. Because the federal government's pay system doesn't assign a salary based on your demographic traits. It assigns a salary based on your job duty and your job responsibility. Jobs are classified according to their duties and the prerequisites to perform the job well. And then there's a salary attached to it. And then the holder of the job, the demographic criteria are irrelevant. And that, I think, is probably the greatest virtue of the federal pay system, and that it has pretty much eliminated discrimination between men and women. If women and men in the same kind of job in the federal government make the same, which is a good thing.
That's a fascinating way to look at it. Correct me if I'm wrong, but although these many years, if you get something from the Congressional Research Service or something from the Congressional Budget Office, you could sort of take it to the bank. I mean, they had a reputation for being, I thought, bipartisan and just, you know, just the facts, ma'am, that kind of thing. But you say this one is a departure?
I think so, you know, but I'll, you know, say that with a caveat. And that is they were asked a particular question, and they answered that particular question. And I don't know how much leeway the CBO has when a member of Congress asks a particular question. But the problem is the way by asking the question in that way, it feeds right into the kind of studies that you talked about, you know, at the beginning of the program that started, like you said, 18 months ago at USA Today, where, you know, the Heritage Foundation and AEI and Cato and all these conservative organizations that set out to, you know, make the case that federal employees were overpaid. Well, the only way you can do that, because it's a huge departure from the kind of analysis that's done by the Bureau of Labor Statistics and Office of Personnel Management and the Federal Salary Council, because they come up with opposite conclusions about the comparison between federal and non-federal pay. The only way you can do that is if you use this thing called a human capital approach, which I'm not going to bother going into that, but basically it analyzes pay based on demographic traits. And, you know, the most misleading thing I think about the CBO study is if you get a hold of a hard copy of it, you'll see that all the charts and graphs emphasize education. And so the headlines in the newspaper and the, you know, takeaway, that what they want you to have as your takeaway is, well, if you're highly educated, the federal government overpays you. But if you only have a high school diploma, the federal government did I say that wrong?
Reverse it. Yeah, that's
okay.
Right. Yeah,
if you're highly educated, the federal government underpays you.
Uh-huh.
If you only have a high school diploma, the federal government overpays you. Education is one of those demographic traits. But the model, if they were, you know, more forthcoming, they would acknowledge in a more clearly that race and gender and age play just as big a role as education in that kind of analysis.
Is there? How would you ask the question, Jackie?
Well, I think that the question, that the way the Federal Salary Council asks it, is exactly the right way, and that's also how the law asks the question. And that is, if you look at people in the private sector, regardless of their age or race or gender, and look at them and do a job-by-job match. How much does the private sector pay for that for the performance of that particular job compared to how much the federal government pays for the performance of that particular job? It's a job match rather than an individual match.
And according to that, since the enactment of the pay law, the government has been, 23 to 28% behind overall?
Yeah. I mean, with the most recent Federal Salary Council report, and, you know, I'm on the Federal Salary Council, says on average 26% behind. But that varies tremendously by city. You know, there are cities where federal employees are way, way, way behind. And, you know, of course, Washington's one of the worst in that regard. And, you know, that's for a lot of reasons. But, you know, there's so much focus on federal pay and very little focus on contractor pay. That's an issue AFGE has tried to bring to the fore this last year. You know, I don't know if your listeners know, but the so-called the cap on executive pay among contractors is right now just under $700,000. It's set to go up to $750,000. But that's only for the top five executives of a contractor, the most highly compensated executives. For all other employees, there is no cap. When I say other employees, I mean contractor employees.
Mm-hmm.
So taxpayers are reimbursing contractors for salaries in the many hundreds of thousands. And with no cap and certainly no freeze.
Jackie, can you hold that thought? We need
sure.
to take a short break here. Talking with Jackie Simon from the AFGE. We'll be right back on WFED 1500 AM.
And now called the Federal Living Report, brought to you by WEPA.
Miss that mass transit subsidy that expired at the end of last year? The government's biggest union wants it back, too. The National Treasury Employees Union is lobbying lawmakers to reinstate it, calling it critical to workers struggling in a down economy. Supportive lawmakers are calling for the benefit to be included in a payroll tax extension that's being negotiated now. But Utah Senator Orrin Hatch gave a reality check. He told Reuters that passage was unlikely before the November elections.
Attention new federal employees. WEPA is currently offering up to $100,000 of life insurance on a guaranteed basis to those individuals within 180 days of their original federal hire date. No medical exam or physician's reports required. WEPA, a nonprofit association founded in 1943, provides life insurance at rates significantly less than the federal program. WEPA also offers premium refunds and a college scholarship program. Visit WAEPA.org to learn more. Once again, WAEPA.org.
Meeting mission goals through health, brought to you by General Dynamics IT.
The Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology is working to identify some best practices for mobile devices. The project aims to help medical providers secure and protect health information on laptops, tablets, and smartphones as those devices continue to proliferate throughout the clinical sector. The ONC will gather public input to identify good practices and then plans to spread those practices through what it promises will be clear, concise, easy to understand language.
General Dynamics IT is meeting the challenges of a complex healthcare environment that requires far-reaching experience and full-spectrum capabilities. Government, military, and commercial health payer organizations rely on General Dynamics IT's health services, solutions, and support to tackle their toughest issues. General Dynamics IT's broad understanding of healthcare data, military health missions, fraud, waste, and abuse protection, and more ensures support and innovation tailored to your real-world needs. Today's healthcare challenges are formidable. To learn more, go to GDIT.com.
Experience GW basketball in one of D.C.'s best college venues, the Colonials Club. As a member of the Colonials Club, you will enjoy a game day atmosphere that is unmatched in Washington area college basketball. Your philanthropic donation and loyal support for GW Athletics provides countless opportunities to our student athletes in pursuit of both their academic and athletic goals. Call 202-994-7325 to join the Colonials Club today and help raise high the Buff and Blue.
America's top show about planning for retirement is on 1500 AM WFED. Sunday mornings at 8, it's the Financial Safari. Each week, America's income planner, Coach Pete DeRuda, sits down with father-daughter duo from Northern Virginia, retirement planners Don and Jill O'Rourke from O'Rourke Asset Management. Sunday mornings at 8, it's the Financial Safari on 1500 AM WFED.
Powered by the latest second-generation Intel Xeon processors, new HP ProLiant G7 servers are a perfect high-speed solution for lowering costs, improving utilization, and reducing server sprawl. GovConnection, a federal elite HP partner, can show you how together they can power your data center into the future. Talk to GovConnection's experienced federal sales team, where service and commitment to the customer are priority one. Call 800-800-0019 today.
With a $1.2 trillion cut to federal spending expected over the next decade, agencies need to consider more than individual programs. They have to dramatically change the way they do business. Join AFSEA Bethesda February 24th at the Bethesda North Marriott for its annual federal budget preview as a distinguished panel of CIOs including Richard Spires, Roger Baker, Chris Smith, and Rob Carey discuss what technologies and initiatives will continue to drive IT spending in 2013. Register today at AFSEABethesda.org/FebBreakfast.
Welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Causey. I'm talking with Jackie Simon. She's Director of Public Policy for the American Federation of Government Employees. Jackie, that was a fascinating assessment of the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office study on pay. In essence, you say the given the question they were asked, this is the conclusion they reached, that if they had to replace and replicate every government employee, how would the private sector do it? And the results would be that by doing that, it would repeat what the private sector does, which is underpay women, underpay minorities, except for Asians, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as I was reading it, I realized the sort of absurd logical policy conclusion of an analysis like that would be for the federal government to really minimize its cost. It would replace its workforce with a workforce made up exclusively of black women, since black women make less than every other demographic category in the private sector. Well, the way to get a cheap workforce would be to reproduce all that inequality we find in the private sector and hire only black women.
Well, that's a fascinating take. It would be interesting to see what the CBO thinks of it. Given this, I think the majority of people in the U.S., whether they're right or wrong, probably do think that government workers have it made, probably do think that government workers are overpaid. And this all seems to be coming to a head. We've had various commissions, committees, super committees last year who talked about things they were going to do to the government to bring it to heel, to lower the costs of government and labor. Nothing happened except for the two-year federal pay freeze. But now we've got, it looks like the stars are lining up for some bad stuff for federal workers.
Well, I listened yesterday to the first meeting of the of a group of 20 lawmakers trying to reconcile differences when it comes to how to pay for the extension of the Social Security payroll tax cut through the rest of this year.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, I'm sure, that the House bill extends the pay freeze, and the Democratic Senate voted to fund it with a tax on millionaires. Also yesterday, there was a markup of an extremely harsh bill in the House that would simultaneously decrease retirement benefits for federal employees and increase the cost for funding those benefits to federal employees. So they'd have to pay more and get less. 1.5% more of income for current employees, and anybody who has less than 5 years experience already, 5 years tenure in the federal government, their first contribution would go up to 4% of their income from 0.8 currently. So that's a huge pay cut. And of course, you got to remember that although this is all cloaked in deficit reduction, these cost increase, cost shifting, and benefit cuts would be permanent. They're not temporary or until the deficit is reduced to a certain amount. So these are hard times, as you say. One of the things you heard over and over yesterday is something we've tried to remind people. There's about 160 million Americans who pay into the Social Security system, people who, earn their incomes through wages and salaries. The House Republicans are asking about 2 million Americans, the federal workforce, to pay maybe 40% of the cost of that tax cut for 160 million. Where is the fairness in that? It just makes no sense whatsoever.
Are those of us who pay into Social Security, including moi, are we being asked by the Congress to pay more?
Private sector workers?
Yes.
No. You're going to get the tax cut.
We get the 2% reduction, right?
Right. And, federal employees in FERS would get the 2% reduction, but they'd simultaneously get various tax increases to pay for, their fellow Americans' tax cut. I mean, it's unbelievable. They don't want us to pick on poor millionaires.
Yeah.
Those decent job-creating Americans, why focus on them and ask them to finance anything? No, instead we'll focus on the federal worker. We'll focus on a VA nursing assistant and a Border Patrol agent or a corrections officer. These are middle-class people, and why they should carry the burden for all the rest of the entire U.S. workforce makes absolutely no sense.
So the deal is that if you're a FERS employee with 5 or more years of service, you'd be okay.
No. You wouldn't get the high 3 to high 5, but you would have to pay 1.5% more of your income toward your annuity.
Okay, that's for everybody. So the 4% total would be for people who with less than 5 years and for new hires?
Yes, but it doesn't stop there. They would dramatically decrease your accrual rate. When you finally retire, there's a formula that multiplies your years of service times your, in this case it would be high 5 average salary times a certain number, which is sometimes called a multiplier. They want to reduce that by about about 38%, I think it is. You know, NARF did some calculations, and their result was that for this group, the average for the annuity would just be around $5,000 a year, a little over $5,000 a year, if those cuts went into effect.
That's incredible. Now, well, and where are they now?
Where this
was marked up yesterday, meaning the committee approved it?
In the committee, right. So it'll go before the full House. And, you know, there's no similar bill that's gotten that far in the Senate. But so, you know, it's troubling because, you know, this whole focus on deficit reduction, as if deficit reduction wouldn't make our struggling economy worse rather than better. But in any case, if they really do continue to focus on deficit reduction almost exclusively as economic policy, then, you know, all these politicians say everything's on the table, including federal employee benefits. So, you know, we're hardly out of danger. And, you know, of course, also there's all kinds of action going on to try to avoid the sequestration, at least for the Department of Defense, and shift it all onto the civilian agencies. And instead of, you know, from the Budget Control Act, remember when the super committee failed, then what happened was this idea of sequestration that would be 50% on Department of Defense and 50% on all the other agencies. Well, there's certainly a lot of political support for protecting DOD. And so if the same amount has to be cut from elsewhere in the budget, that puts federal employees' jobs certainly in jeopardy. And pay and benefits as well.
So Senator McCain and Senator Kyle and some others have proposed this, shifting this away from defense to avoid sequestration for defense, and
right.
And one of the things would be, what is it, a pay freeze effectively until January of 2015. Is that right?
I'm not 100% sure of the details of all that, but. Because I think there are more than one proposal out there. Because one thing that happens when they protect just DOD, then there becomes the question of, oh, well, wait a second, what about DHS? What about VA? So, you know, every time you protect one agency, it's just bigger cuts on everything else. And so there are multiple ideas out there right now for, you know, who gets protected and who gets to, you know, what gets to bear the brunt of these massive spending cuts.
Well, you know, sometimes, not to simplify it and dumb it down, but given what we've seen over the last couple of years, last year we had the super committee. That was the last great hope. It did nothing. You had the Biden group, the Blair House group. It did nothing. You had a group appointed by President Obama, bipartisan panel or a citizens panel, that it made some recommendations, but nothing happened. You had five or six major efforts last year in which nothing happened except for the pay freeze itself. Isn't it possible that with all of this horror show that's going on now and all of the threats to federal workers, to their pay, to their benefits, to their retirement, that maybe nothing will happen? But
well, I don't know that nothing will happen. I mean, but the Budget Control Act did pass, and the sequestration threat was supposed to really force the super committee to do something, but or, you know, come up with some kind of deal. But the Republicans, you know, held very, very fast to absolutely not a dime of, increased revenue, or at least that's what news reports suggested. And so we have this law on the books that will, in fact, trigger these sequestration cuts unless other legislation is passed that, supersedes it. So absent the passage of other legislation, yeah, these cuts will really happen.
But the thing about it, and correct me if I'm wrong, is sequestration, I thought, didn't take effect until January of 2013.
That's right.
That's right. Okay. So, I mean, we've got to break it off here, Jackie, but it just seems to me like they may decide to kick the can down past the election date and let the next group handle it.
I think you're right. I think that's what will happen, and that's why we'll have to, you know, fight really hard in this election.
Listen, we'll have you back. Thank you very much, Jack.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Take a short break here. Be back talking to the Federal Times folks.
my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around a mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is Geico anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that Geico isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how Geico actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, Geico saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like Geico. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. Geico.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact Geico today to request your special federal savings.
On November 17, 2011, the future of air and missile defense changed forever. MEADS, the Medium Extended Air Defense System, demonstrated the first ever over-the-shoulder launch against a simulated target. It was an unprecedented breakthrough and proved that only MEADS, with its 360-degree coverage, can defend our warfighters against air and missile defense threats from any direction. MEADS has the advanced capabilities and reliability that the 40-year-old Patriot system can't provide and will cost half as much to man and maintain versus upgrading Patriot. MEADS 360-degree coverage defends more area with fewer assets and has the lethality to defeat advanced threats. Defending more, costing less. MEADS. For more information, go to MEADS-AMD.com. That's MEADS-AMD.com.
Paid for by Lockheed Martin.
Register now for AFSEA's 11th Annual Homeland Security Event, February 28th through March 1st at the Reagan Center. Focusing on vigilance during challenging times, doing more without more, this is the venue where you will hear firsthand about the critical IT issues facing our country in the fight against terrorism. This event is proudly sponsored by AT&T, Booz Allen Hamilton, CenturyLink, General Dynamics, InfoZen, NJVC, Kinetic North America, SAIC, and Verizon, and features speakers from all levels of government, military, and industry. Panelists from across the Homeland Security enterprise will dialogue on border security, cyberspace, immigration, disaster response, doing business with DHS, and other critical issues. Contractors and agencies will showcase the latest security products and solutions in the exposition. Register to attend or exhibit at afcea.org, keyword homeland. That's afcea.org.
Be at Verizon Center when the Caps take on the Winnipeg Jets on Thursday, February 9th, and the San Jose Sharks on Monday, February 13th. Caps games are always huge events. The fans are always pumped up. Always a great time. This is the hottest ticket in town. Tickets are extremely limited. So call 202-397-SEAT, 202-397-SEAT, or log on to washingtoncaps.com/singleticks now and do your part in building America's hockey capital.
Imagine a 23-foot-long video wall that provides 100 times more detail than the best high-definition TV. It exists, but sorry, sports fans, only for science right now. The screen at the University of California in Irvine displays pictures ranging from microscopic to telescopic using 200 million pixels on 50 high-definition TVs.
The real trick is the software to be able to coordinate this stuff, to be able to make all the displays act as if they're one.
Stephen Jenks, chief scientist at Hyperwall, says it allows unprecedented clarity, zooming in or out. He foresees engineering advances that will seamlessly fuse all that image data onto huge, rollable screens.
Instead of wallpaper and instead of a television, you can just have this stuff mounted on your wall.
And surround yourself with video. To find out more, please go to www.nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
And talking with Stephen Losey and Sean Riley from the Federal Times. Gentlemen, you with us?
Good morning.
Okay, everybody in the same room?
Yep. Yeah.
Okay, great, great minds assemble here. Listen, first off, this there's so much happening, don't really know where to begin. I'm like one of those, you see a cheetah running into a herd of gazelles, and you don't know which one to tackle. This latest threat to STEP increases. What would that mean, and how real is it?
Well, Congressman Roby from Alabama late last week introduced a bill that would basically eliminate STEP increases for the rest of the year, from the point when Martha Roby's proposed bill gets passed through December 31st. And this would mean no periodic STEP increases that federal employees would otherwise get every 1, 2, or 3 years, assuming they're less than a step 10. And it would also eliminate all the other kinds of step increases, such as particularly quality step increases that are awarded when someone really does a bang-up job.
And these are worth 3%, correct?
Yeah, it averages out to 3%.
And you did in fact, it was your study a year ago in April, and you looked at the numbers, and just looking at the numbers, it appears that virtually everybody who comes up for a step increase gets one.
That's right. It was about only one in every 1,700 employees who are up for a step increase get their step increase denied for reasons of poor performance, which Republicans say is a sign that the performance management system in the federal government is toothless, and that the step increase system is all but guaranteed for everybody. Now, unions say that's not true. They say that the general schedule does provide for a way to punish poor performance by withholding these step increases, but the raw numbers just don't really bear that out for the vast majority of people.
I mean, any of us who are in a large organization would say there are X number of incompetents here. You know, it's just the way it is. What do you have any conclusion on this? Do you think the system is working, or does it need some fixing?
I think the system needs some fixing. I'm not sure what that would look like. There's certainly been a lot of things tried, but I think the fact that only one in 1,700 employees had their pay raise withheld. I'm not talking about firing people. I'm not talking about cutting their pay. I'm just saying they didn't get a pay raise. I got to think there's more than one in every 1,700 federal employees who didn't do a great enough job to merit a pay raise. And that, to me, is a sign that something is wrong with the general schedule system. Something needs to be done. But it's not quite. It's really not looking like they're going to tackle anything anytime soon.
Well, the National Security Personnel System was supposed to correct that, and in fact, the people who were under it tended to get larger raises than they would have under the GS system. But the counter argument to that is that because of union opposition and because the management wanted to implement this thing one way or another, that they excluded people who were covered by unions, that is, in bargaining units. And so you had a pool of people in the NSPS that were sort of management-oriented or management-related, and that they gave them better raises to make the system look better.
I don't know if they gave the raises specifically to make the system look better, but, yeah, I can agree with everything else you said. I'm not disputing. I just don't know. But, yeah, the unions were excluded from NSPS, and it did tend to be more management-heavy. But, you know, and the unions did oppose it, and they lobbied the Democrats in Congress to kill it. But another big problem with NSPS was that the studies that Federal Times did on the results of NSPS showed there were clear discriminatory effects on from NSPS. Women, members of minority ethnicities received lower pay raises on average than men and white employees. So, yeah, there were some problems with NSPS, and they were trying to fix it, but then the system got killed.
There was a committee markup yesterday that does some very interesting things to the federal retirement system. What is that?
That's right. The House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, that's the one headed by Congressman Daryl Issa, they passed a bill called the Securing Annuities for Federal Employees Act. This is now headed to the full House. This contains at least some of the things that we've been talking about for a while. It would increase the amount that federal employees pay towards their FERS or their CSRS systems by half a percentage point per year for 3 years. That means that FERS employees, instead of contributing 0.8% of their paycheck, they contribute 2.3% of their paycheck towards their pensions. And for CSRS, they contribute 8.5% instead of the 7% they pay now. It would also eliminate the FERS annuity supplement that covers Social Security, that is the equivalent of Social Security payments for people who aren't eligible for Social Security, and it would really hit new employees, future employees. They would get the high five instead of the high three. They would have their pensions calculated at a lower 0.7% rate instead of the 1% or 1.1% FERS employees now get, and they would contribute 4% of their salaries towards their pensions instead of the 0.8 now. It would really hit future employees, and not surprisingly, unions and other federal employee groups and Democratic lawmakers are apoplectic about this bill.
The Jackie Simon from the AFG was talking about this a bit before you guys came on, and did I understand that this the high five would apply to new hires, future hires?
People hired after this year who have less than 5 years prior service in the federal government.
Okay, so does that mean if I'm in the government now and I have 4.5 years of service, or I had 4.5 years service December 31st, that I would go into this new system?
No, it would only be if you were hired after December 31st.
Coming back.
And people who
had 5 years prior to coming back, they would be grandfathered in.
That's right.
You have any idea what kind of numbers we're talking about here, numbers of people? How many people does the government hire in a typical year?
Honestly, I'm sorry, I'm kind of blanking on that number right
I just wondered if there was some numbers, particularly thinking if they applied the 5 year rule back, but that's really not an issue. So what else is going on?
Well, the issue of the incomplete annuities, the problem we've been talking about for more than a year now, the Office of Personnel Management has a hard time calculating pensions for new retirees in a speedy manner. And as a result, there are tens of thousands of federal employees who are stuck with incomplete annuities, sometimes pensions that are half of what they're owed for many, many months, some more than a year. Now, this seems to be getting a little bit more traction on the Hill lately. There was a hearing last week on it, and Director Barry reiterated his pledge to fix this solution. But it seems like some lawmakers are kind of losing patience with OPM. Senators Mark Warner of Virginia and Maryland Senators Barbara Mikulski and Ben Cardin, they sent a letter to Jeff Zients, the acting director of the Office of Management and Budget, asking basically OMB to step in and kind of ride herd on OPM to make sure they get this problem solved. They say they want reports from OPM on how they're going to fix this, how they're agencies that aren't submitting accurate retirement documents, which is one of the things that's holding them up. But what I found most interesting is these senators want a plan by the next 2014 budget on how the government is going to completely automate the retirement system. That's the only way, they say, that this problem is going to be solved once and for all. And it's something that OPM has tried in the past, and it's failed, it's crashed and burned. OPM says the system is just there's just way too many systems, it's too complicated, it's too vast to come up with a one-size-fits-all automated process to automate these the processing of retirement documents. But Congress, they're not buying it. They say that there's got to be some way, and they want to see a plan.
Well, and right now it's first, there's so much paperwork involved. I want to ask you about that when we come back here. Take a short break here on 1500 AM.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series, Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m., right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Hey, man. What's up? Angie went to Walmart and got this cool Pioneer HD radio receiver. And now she's like, I don't know.
Simple stuff. Check out the buyer's guide at HDradio.com.
Cool buyer's guide. Oh, here's the Pioneer DEH-44 under $120 at Walmart. Angie, hip and smart.
See, dude, HDradio.com has the answers you need, and Walmart has the Pioneer with built-in HD radio technology you want. Now all you need to do is learn how to talk to girls.
Learn about HD radio technology at HDradio.com. More radio, more value.
Facing a new day, delivering services efficiently, improving citizens' lives, Booz Allen Hamilton supports the most important challenges of government, from defense and economic security to health and cyber solutions. Booz Allen strategy and technology consultants partner with clients to deliver results that endure. Whether managing today's issues or looking beyond the horizon, clients can count on Booz Allen to help them be ready for what's next. BoozAllen.com/ready for what's next.
Listen to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio 1500 AM every Friday morning at 11, brought to you by the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth. Fed Talk features live interviews with guests from the federal community sharing their insights on issues that affect you. Call in or email questions to Fed Talk at federalnewsradio.com. Fed Talk is sponsored by GEICO. This week on Fed Talk, host Deborah Roth will lead a roundtable discussion on federal employment training issues in Maryland and Virginia and federal resume writing issues and challenges.
If you are facing advanced illness or the end of life of a loved one, peace of mind is in short supply. Fortunately, pain-free comfort care is available from the Washington Home and Community Hospices, a not-for-profit organization with a holistic team of doctors, nurses, caregivers, social workers, chaplains, and volunteers. The team comes to you in your home or wherever you call home in D.C., Montgomery, or Prince George's County. For your peace of mind, call them day or night for a complimentary consultation at 866-234-7222.
How is the U.S. Air Force improving financial information and achieving audit readiness? What is the U.S. Air Force doing to improve its financial operations, become more efficient, and control costs? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and much more with Dr. Jamie Morin, Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Financial Management and Controller, next week on the Business of Government Hour.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around the mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like GEICO. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. GEICO.
To get a free rate quote, go to GEICO.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact GEICO today to request your special federal savings.
For 125 years, Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington has served the youth of our nation's capital and its surrounding communities. Your support will help over 21,000 youth who need you most walk through the doors of a Boys and Girls Club and walk out with a plan for their future. Every dollar donated in fiscal year 2012 will be matched up to $250,000 by Stanley Martin Homes. You can help. Go online to www.bgcgw.org and change someone's life. This message brought to you by GEICO.
Did you know Federal News Radio can also be heard on 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland? Check it out the next time you head to Fort Detrick or the I-270 Technology Corridor. Tune in to Federal News Radio for the latest news and information about the federal government and the federal contracting world. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM or 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland. Federal News Radio, your source for federal news now.
Well, Welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Causey. You're talking with Steve Losey from the Federal Times. Steve, to wrap up, because I wanted to get to your colleague, Sean Riley, this backlog that OPM is experiencing now in retirements, it's not going to go away anytime soon. And given the surge in buyouts and the number of people who are aging and getting ready to retire, the advice for anybody preparing to retire is to have lots of money saved up, right?
That's right. You know, sometimes these people who are on their interim pensions, OPM says it takes an average of 5 months to get to finish processing. Now, an average means some people are less than 5 months, some people a lot more.
Yeah.
So I would say you should at least have it at the bare minimum 6 months cash on hand to get by, to pay your mortgage, to keep gas in your car, and pay for food. You know, just because you don't want to start tapping into your TSP earlier than expected.
Exactly. Wilson, thank you so much, Steve. Sean, are you there?
I'm here.
Hey, we got some exciting news. The FAA, which has been a kind of a political football for several years now, finally got out of the woods, huh?
Can you believe it? It's amazing how quickly Congress can act when it actually wants to act. On Friday, the House passed a four-year reauthorization of FAA programs that will run through 2015. On Monday, the Senate followed suit. So after 23 stopgap extensions to 2007, the FAA now has, you know, basically knows essentially how much money it's authorized to have, you know, for the next 3.5 years, basically.
You know, congressmen are among literally the highest flyers in the country. They're constantly on the road and in the air, and I never could comprehend how they could let something like this happen, as you said, 23 times.
Yeah, it's just baffling, and you know, really, the situation had not changed. You know, the political landscape hadn't changed much since last summer when, as you recall, you had about 3,700 or so FAA employees that were furloughed for 2 weeks. Basically because Congress, you know, didn't bother to pass another one of those short-term extensions and then left town for their August break. And in this case, you know, they passed a couple more, and then all of a sudden, boom, just wrapped things up. And I don't think in a lot of ways the final bill was that much, you know, was appreciably that much different from what they've been considering all along.
Right, and the fascinating, horrifying thing, and it shows you how petty the government can be here, is the FAA employees that were furloughed, told to go home and couldn't work, were people involved in health and safety and checking out the health and safety of other of people in the flying community. And many of them, as I understand it, went to work really, I guess, in violation of the rules, but went in on their own because they were literally indispensable and they couldn't do without them.
Right, that they were considered essential, and so they worked, you know, at that time without a paycheck. I believe they've since been reimbursed, but you know, the Congress took so much flack over this episode, particularly just leaving town without having dealt with this. And also, let's not forget, there were thousands of construction workers working on FAA, you know, modernization projects around the country that were also out of work. And those folks, as far as I know, didn't get any back pay for the time they were out since they were working for private contractors.
I think the number I saw was 70,000, many as 70,000.
It was very high. And again, this is, you know, at a time when you've got, you know, we don't need to be adding to the jobless rate by congressional inaction. And I think probably that left such a bad taste in voters' mouths. I think Congress was a little bit chagrined and realized they had to get this off the table.
Yeah, somebody up there, and they need a good public relations operation. Don't furlough government and put 70,000 contractors out of work at a time of high unemployment while you yourself are going on vacation. Not
exactly. Yeah, the optics were not great.
Yeah, correct. Hey, how about postal reform? Where's that going?
Well, that's an excellent question. At the moment, it's going nowhere. Mm-hmm. There were, you know, this, you know, right now all the action's in the Senate, and there were hopes, there were expectations that the Senate would have already taken up legislation that came out of the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee late last fall, you know, that's being very closely watched by postal workers, because if it were enacted, this would, you know, would allow the Postal Service to tap into about $7 billion in excess payments to the federal employees' retirement system and use those for employee buyouts and early retirements, you know, essentially incentives to get, you know, up to like 125,000 postal workers to leave early, and therefore, you know, bring the workforce down to, you know, somewhere around the level that the Postmaster General thinks is needed, you know, given the fall off in revenue. But, however, there's been a lot of opposition from, you know, key members of the Senate Democratic Caucus that are concerned that even though this bill would impose a 2-year moratorium on the, you know, before the Postal Service could close any post offices. They don't want any post offices closed ever, apparently, and so they've been holding up the bill from coming, you know, they've been blocking the bill essentially from coming up for floor consideration. So things are really hung up at this point. I think it tends to give credence to people who say that nothing is going to happen on significant postal reform legislation until after the November election.
I think it's hard for us living in cities and in urban areas to realize how important a small post office is. It may even be in a general store or a gas station, but to some communities, it's a place where people, they even go in and pick up their mail, but they meet, greet. It acts as the banker in some communities, and it's also a sense of identity. That postmark, if in these rare situations where people still send letters, is very important to people.
Oh, absolutely. I worked in a state that for a long time that, you know, has a lot of very rural areas. And as you say, the post office, the local post office is a sign of community identity. And particularly for, you know, small towns that have seen decline because, you know, major industry left or, you know, young people have moved away, you having that post office there, even if it's not used as much, you know, as it was in the past, it's still a sign that you are a viable community. And when you take that away, the sense is, you know, that it's one more, you know, one more blow, one more sign of decline. And I thought it was interesting last year when the post, you know, the Postal Service unveiled this plan for village post offices, where you would have some postal, you know, if a post office closed, you'd have some services such as, you know, stamp sales, flat rate packages, that kind of thing, would be handled under contract, say by a general store. That the Postal Service would still allow that community to keep its local, to keep its individual zip code.
You know, of course, when the Postal Service became the Postal Service, it switched from a cabinet level, a post office department, and became the Postal Service. The idea was it was going to be run like a business. They were going to get rid of congressional subsidies, which I guess they eventually did. They were going to operate, but nobody could foresee Federal Express or these other carriers, and certainly nobody could foresee the internet and the use of email and whatnot. But it's almost as if they, by setting themselves up as a business-like operation, they were doomed to fail, because as long as they were part of the cabinet, people expected a subsidy, and they expected that we would subsidize the fact that carrying the mail is a very tough job, and you have to carry a letter from Tampa, Florida to Nome, Alaska for the same 44 cents as one across town. And now with the profit motive and pay your own way, it seems like it's doomed.
Well, essentially, in its current form, I mean, if you hear, you know, listen to postal leadership, it is. I mean, that it cannot continue on the path it's on. They say it's unsustainable. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see tomorrow the Postal Service announces its first quarter financial results. This covers the period from beginning of October to the end of December, which, of course, encompasses the holiday shipping season, which is usually their best quarter. I'm told that the expectation is the results will be less bad than expected. They won't be good. They won't be making money, but it won't be quite as bad as that they might have once foreseen, which may mean that they can muddle through the rest of this year without a major crisis. You know, at one point they were saying they were going to run out of money by August, and now that's been pushed back. The last I heard, and it was at the luncheon that the Postmaster General spoke at the National Press Club back in November. They were saying they might run out of money might have difficulty paying their bills by October. And so if they can keep putting it all, you know, this day of reckoning off, as long as possible, Congress is, you know, will probably not act until that point.
Okay. Well, it just seems to me that they've got nowhere to go. And, you know, when you're talking about setting up your own health plan, which people who know the health plan business say that's a non-starter.
Well, it has been so far. I mean, Office of Personnel Management is, has raised some concerns about it. You know, of course, labor and, unions representing employees as well as management associations aren't enthusiastic, to put it mildly. And the Postal Service, as far as I know, has really not put out any, I think it was talked about before, has not really put out a detailed plan about how they would make this transition.
Okay, good. Listen, Sean, thank you so much. Steve, thanks for being here with us. We'll talk to you guys next week. Meanwhile, everybody out there, watch out for the snow. Have a good week, and we'll see you next Wednesday.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks.